Hi, good evening, everyone. This is John Cavill introducing Miracle Hour on bbsradio.com. We welcome our listeners everywhere. This is the hour where we get to talk to lots of interesting people and to hear about all sorts of matters spiritual and different stages of people's journey of awakening. And this evening, folks, I've got a wonderful gentleman whose name is Ralph McIntyre, and Ralph was very instrumental in my journey. I went to work in a rehab center as a volunteer, and Ralph was my supervisor and the guy that ran the center. And he's a very experienced addiction counselor with 17 years experience in the addiction field. And he's got quite a life story himself. So it's a great pleasure for me tonight to welcome you, Ralph. And how are you doing this evening, my friend?
I'm doing very good, John. How are you?
Yeah, it's great to have you here as my guest tonight. I appreciate you giving your time to the people. And while I was waiting to come on, I was kind of just reflecting back to when we first met. And it seems like a long time ago now, but I remember coming down to Bromwell Road, wasn't it?
That's right.
And somebody had told me I had to find a placement for my course. I was doing a course in counselling at the time, and somebody had recommended that I go and see you. They thought.
I'm just trying to think how long ago that was now. Probably, are we talking
8 years?
10 years ago, John?
Maybe nine. Yeah, but a fair way. And it was a wonderful encounter. I remember that we clicked straight away. And tell us a little bit, Ralph, about your involvement with addiction recovery. And I know you're going to share quite a bit about what's underneath the addiction. But it'd be great to hear a little bit about your story and how you got where you are. Hello. Hi, Ralph. Hi, Ralph. So you can hear me now again, huh?
I can hear you, John. I can hear you well.
Say the joys of modern technology, huh?
That's right. I always expect the unexpected.
Yeah, I think what I was just saying to our listeners there was that, underneath all addictions is a lot of other stuff going on, and I think that was very clear because I remember very clearly coming into your group as a volunteer, so I was really sitting in there kind of supposed to be learning, and you gave me a piece to read. Do you remember that?
I do. It was called The Precious Present.
That was right, and it was a pretty lengthy piece, and I remember I must have got through about a third of it, do you think? And
third, half, maybe, yeah.
And I was just in bits. I couldn't read it, and you very, very gently and very cleverly just kind of stepped in and finished the piece off. I've got something else to finish it off. But it was a great, great, example of how much pain, people carry around with them, and when they get rid of the drug or the whatever that happens to be, there's a mountain of pain to deal with. And I think you want to
That's
talk
right.
a little bit about that tonight.
Yeah, I mean, behind all addiction is a lack of love. Addiction is the cover-up for love. And I still use that that poem, The Precious Present, and it talks about a man's journey looking for his authentic self and the ability to be able to live in the here and now,
yeah.
In the present.
Yeah, and I think that was the part that really triggered me into my pain was the fact that as I read it, the journey that he was taking, what I connected with was my own years and years of searching and for this real self. And, that really, it was a massive trigger, and I think that's what most people are covering up, isn't it?
Yeah. I mean, addiction is about... Well, firstly, if we just look at the word addiction, it comes from a Greek word, addictus, which means to be a slave.
To be a slave.
So addiction is enslavement, and And in the process, one creates a full self. And, you know, the journey we're discussing tonight, John, is a journey to find, to reclaim our authentic self.
Yeah. And that part of us that is not separated from source.
That's right. That never was.
That's it. And I mean, I think it would be nice for you to explain a little bit about codependency, because I know you talked a lot about that, and a lot of the work that we did in the center was uncovering the codependency. And you know, I certainly had never heard of codependency. And then when I did get to learn about it, it was almost like, well, most of society think that's normal.
Most of society does think that codependency is normal. Our films, the music, the popular music, is geared towards codependency.
Yeah, promoting codependency. Could you explain a little bit to our listeners what you see? How do you would you describe codependency?
Codependency is an addiction. It's people addiction. It's an addiction to being needed. So within codependency, you cannot be codependent on your own. You need two players. One is the hostage. The other is the hostage taker. And within a relationship, it's very possible for one to play one role at one time and then to reverse it. And perhaps another way I could describe it, John, is you've got the codependent, and then you've got their partner. The partner will be grandiose, will be invasive, will present as being very, very self-assured. But in fact, all of that's a cover-up. They need a support actor to help them keep that belief system in place. And then you've got the codependent who, their role is to support, because, you know, they're coming from a sense of low self-esteem, low self-worth. They're only of any value if they can support other people.
Right.
That made it a little clearer?
Yeah, that explains it. And, I mean, I can relate to that, because I know that before I started to go on this inner journey, I can remember people would say to me, oh, my God, I wish I had your confidence.
Yeah.
And I would kind of go, oh, my God, if only you knew, you know. This was such a big cover-up, as you called it, cover-up. I think it's a great term.
And very often...
Sorry?
And very often a person will use a chemical, will use alcohol, will use cocaine, will use a drug to boost that self-confidence, that false confidence. Dutch courage, maybe it's called.
Yeah, well, that's it, and that's exactly what I did. And I look back, and when I eventually put down the drink and got to being without anything, my God, I felt like a five-year-old child.
Yeah.
And the lovely thing about this journey of awakening, once you're committed to the spiritual, you know, path and the healing path, is that eventually you get to a stage where that confidence is genuine.
It's real.
I don't feel like a phony. I used to feel like a phony all the time, but I wouldn't let anybody know that. I used to, because I put all the camouflage on, the suit and the car and the briefcase.
And John, if we look at codependency as an addiction, any addiction, there's a way to monitor whether you're in an addiction or not. And that way is, if we've got an alcoholic, for example, the more their illness progresses, the smaller the rest of their life becomes. if we've got a shopaholic who gets their paycheck, goes out and burns their gold card and buys five suits and three pairs of shoes, their life's going to be very much smaller the rest of the month. You know, for example, they may not have the money to eat or money for their children. A codependent, the more they get enmeshed in the other person's life, the smaller their own life becomes. They won't be able to choose their own friends. They won't be able to engage in their own pastimes, their own pursuits. They will lose their own set of values and adopt somebody else's.
Right. Okay. So what I really get that. So in other words, what you're saying is that when codependency, which you've explained is an addiction itself, what happens is you become so enmeshed in the other person's way of life that you lose all sense of your own.
You forget your own.
Even be afraid to do what you want to do yourself?
Yes, because behind codependency there's a fear, and that fear is abandonment.
And then what? It's a really tough one. I mean, I think my recovering process, and I totally accept and acknowledge that it's a lifelong recovery process, codependency, was far tougher for me than actually putting down the alcohol. And I think that possibly because society does support and kind of honor codependency in many ways, as you've said, and it is a tough one, Ralph, isn't it? That balance between supporting and assisting.
Sure. And if we look at drug addiction, if we look at alcoholism, if we look at an addiction to gambling, any of those addictions, you can do total abstinence. You can say, okay, I'm going to be totally abstinent from alcohol. I'm going to be totally abstinent from drugs. I'm not going to gamble. The two addictions that are the hardest, one is codependency because you can't do total abstinence from people. And it's for his food.
Oh, you've gone again, Al.
Are you there, John?
You've gone again.
Can you hear me?
Well, listeners, I apologize for this small technical delay, but I'm sure Donald will get us back on very shortly. Back again, Ralph.
Hello, John.
Yeah. So where were you there before the gremlins came in? You were just...
Well, we were talking about codependency, and what I was saying was, your comment was, after putting the chemicals down, you found that codependency is a lifelong process to address. And my comment was, addictions like alcohol, we can do total abstinence, we can decide not to drink, but we can't do total abstinence from people.
That's right. Yeah, that's right. You were going to say the two hardest were. You were just going to mention the
other. The two hardest, codependency and, of course, food. We need to eat.
Sure. Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. Yeah, no, I can understand that. And it's really interesting because I think that that total abstinence, I mean, I guess the only way possible would be to go into onto a mountainside for 3 months. But it is interesting, you know, that I came across a program to help people who were suffering from obesity and overeating.
Yeah.
And that actually required total abstinence. It was a supplement, like a powder supplement, but it did actually insist on total abstinence from any food whatsoever. And it was quite a successful program, and I think that was one of the reasons.
Yeah, I know that program. It's become quite popular in the UK, and many people are successful with the abstinence part of it. Where they fall down is when they reintroduce food again.
Yeah, yeah. So with this, you know, I mean, I want to give people, I'm always, you know, the program is Miracle Hour, and I totally believe in miracles, and I know you do as well. They happen all the time in our own lives. So what do you see as the healing process? Because you talk a lot, I remember you talking a lot and you teaching me a lot when I was in the center about shame and addiction and shame being one of the Siamese twins. Well, would you like to say a little bit more about that?
Yeah, sure. Shame and addiction are Siamese twins. You don't get one without the other. And shame is a sense of being flawed. It's a soul sickness. It's not just feeling bad about yourself. It's a sense that you're flawed to the core of your being, to your very soul. And how does that come about? That comes about, well, when I was a child, what I was told was I was born with original sin. So rather than being told that, you know, I was a wonderful child of God, I was made in his image, you know, by the very fact that I'd taken or been given human life, I was flawed. The original sin, I was separate from God. Many people with addiction problems have been abused, sexually, emotionally, mentally abused,
and physically
too. And so an individual is left with a sense of worthlessness. You know, currently in the UK, there's a new phrase. It's called time poor.
Time poor?
Time poor. People don't have enough time.
Oh, I see what you mean. P-O-O-R, poor, yeah.
Yeah. So, you know, Dad gets on the train at 6 o'clock in the morning and goes to London and does his work in his office and comes back at 9 o'clock at night, doesn't see his child. So the child begins to feel that they're worth less than Dad's time. Or the alcoholic is drinking, so the child begins to feel that they're worth less than alcohol.
So
there's this sense of worthlessness.
Yeah.
And it's painful. So what does the child do? It seeks out an anesthetic for that emotional pain, for that spiritual bankruptcy.
Yeah. Instead of the child being honored in every way for who they are rather than what they give back.
That's right.
Because that's what I think is at the center of every one of us. It's one of our greatest needs is to be accepted and loved totally as we are, for who we are, you know, not with reference to what we give back to somebody else.
It's a fundamental need.
Yeah.
And a lot of children, let me put it, let's go back a bit further. We've got a teenager, maybe a guy, maybe a woman, and their big fear is abandonment. So they come up with a scheme, and the scheme is, if I have a child, if I have a baby, that baby, because the baby needs them to survive, can't abandon me. So they have a child, and the child picks up that actually what they're doing is they're meeting the mother or the father's need.
Yeah.
And
yeah.
They live
that's the big one.
And they live in fear.
Yeah.
And they learn codependency. The reason they're there is to meet somebody else's need rather than their own.
Absolutely. And I mean, and that is so common, isn't it? So very common.
Yeah.
So it's almost like a role reversal. So in other words, instead of the child realizing that the parent is there for them and
yeah.
is there to meet their needs, the child gets the message, and of course it's not stuck on the notice board, as Bradshaw would say. It's not stuck on the freezer, but the child gets it at a very deep level that unless they're there for that parent, there's going to be hell let loose.
Yeah, and you were talking about the healing process, and the large part of the healing of the shame, the healing of the addiction, the healing of the codependency is to do that inner child work.
Yeah, yeah.
And
so are you a great advocate then of that deep, deep inner child work?
Absolutely. I know how much value it's been in my own life. Because I was born into a family where addiction was rife. My mother was addicted to medication, prescription medication, and my father was a codependent. In fact, he was a codependent up to his very last breath. He died doing the washing up in the kitchen. And I didn't see him, but from what I've been told, the look on his face was one of absolute rage.
And I think that's what comes over very clear, isn't it? Because, like we said before, so many of these codependencies, I mean, they're actually honored by society, these addictions, like, you know, work addiction is rewarded in the workplace,
yeah.
You know, the guy that, or the woman, in this, and it's both, one of the biggest tragedies, because it's both now, isn't it, because there's so many women going out to work,
yeah.
and of course that's all fine, but it's about, everything's about balance, and it is a tough one, because
it's,
you know, families
it is a tough one.
Yeah. And, but it's like they're rewarded for that. You know, they're looked upon as the great worker that gets in at 7 in the morning and doesn't get finished their work till 8 at night. And what would you say then, in your own experience, what is the turning point? What is the point where people say there must be a better way, enough is enough?
Okay. People only change when it gets painful enough. When the pain of staying the same becomes greater than the fear of changing, that's when an individual changes. So what it often takes is somebody to walk in and say, hey, I've found a better way.
Right.
So there needs to be a moment of clarity where the individual that's in their codependency and their addiction is hurting enough, it's got bad enough, coincides with somebody demonstrating that they found a different way.
Yeah.
And the person that's in their pain will recognize, their soul will recognize whether that person is genuine or not. In my clinical work, I see people, they're checking me out. They're looking for the mirroring eyes. They're looking for the echoing voice. And in psychotherapy, self-disclosure is seen as an absolute no-no, almost a taboo. But I think it's invaluable.
I totally get that. You know, in an appropriate time and an appropriate amount, I think that's right. But I really get what you said about looking for a mirror, because, you know, there is so many people, this is my experience anyway, is doing this work, working in this field, and actually using their positions doing this work, who haven't done the kind of inner work you're talking about, which you advocate so much and which I do as well. I'm absolutely
committed to that, you know. But there are so many people who don't want to go there and don't do that, and they actually end up using the clients as a way of avoiding looking at themselves.
That's right.
I think that's a point that's really important to get across. And sometimes these people, you know, get and occupy high positions, and it's a very, very subtle one, isn't it?
And it's a very subtle one, and it can again replicate the codependency. The client is meeting the counselor or the therapist's needs, and at its worst, it can become secondary abuse.
Absolutely, yeah, absolutely, yeah. No, and that's a very big thing to get across. So I always advocate to people that ask me about, you know, going in and getting assistance to really check out their therapist. They have every right to ask as many questions of their therapist as the therapist can ask about them, I believe.
Yeah, certainly when somebody phones me up and they're looking at the possibility of me working with them, what I suggest is that we meet up and we interview each other.
That's wonderful, Ralph. That's what I found with you. I mean, you know, when you talked about the mirroring eyes, I knew I was in the right place, because I think when I came for my first interview, we sat in that little room at the back behind the kitchen.
Yeah, that's right.
And I think I was bawling my eyes out after 15 minutes with you, you know. And that was,
sure,
that was a great, if you like, great validation, because it meant my child felt safe enough to come out and express the pain.
Yeah.
And it's incredible, you know, how many people are running around with oceans of tears. I remember feeling like I had this frozen lake on my chest. I think we used to talk about it, you know.
Yeah.
You used to talk about wanting a blow lamp to
melt
thaw it out.
Yeah, is there a way we can put a blow lamp on this?
Yeah, absolutely.
And all it takes is a little tenderness.
Yeah, that's it. Yeah, well, the purpose, but one of the things on my show is, you know, I'm a great student of A Course in Miracles, a very committed student, very, very young student of the Course. But one of the things that A Course in Miracles says is that love, the presence of love, brings anything unlike itself to the surface in order to be healed. And I really recognize that, don't you?
I do, because if we cut right back, there's really only two emotions, fear and love. And fear and love can't coexist.
Yeah, yeah, and that's exactly what the Course is saying. And the other fascinating thing that I noticed, which I'd like you to give some insight into, what I saw is so many people, and my mother was one, you know, she put the drink down, but she didn't really open her mind up to the spiritual element of our lives, you know, the fact that we're actually spiritual beings having a human experience and not the other way around.
Sure.
And it's very interesting, isn't it, that people who do not embrace that, and in no way am I condemning that or whatever, because I think everyone's got their journey, but it does appear that people who don't embrace the spiritual element of recovery really seem to struggle. And a classic example is the tragic story of George Best, you know, the great soccer player who ended up having a liver transplant, the whole thing, because he, as I understood, he continually rejected the 12-step program or anything akin to spirituality.
That was my understanding, that he saw his problem as alcohol, and the problem isn't alcohol. The problem is that there's a spiritual bankruptcy.
Yeah.
And recovery is a spiritual journey. I hear people talking about the spiritual side of the program. Well, that loses me, because I don't know what the other side is.
Yeah, exactly. And the spiritual can take many different paths. I think that's the thing I learned, isn't it? And there is no right or wrong path.
No.
Because everyone's got their own.
No. Everybody's got their own journey, their own path. And, you know, if we look at the words in the third step of a 12-step program, it's, you know, God as the individual understands that word.
Yeah, yeah. But, and I think that was the beautiful thing about the 12-step program, was that it gave people an opportunity to come with their own concept of God or higher power. And with to people who had had maybe a very bad experience of God through various religious indoctrinations, etc.,
yeah.
It was a tremendous opening, wasn't it?
Yeah. Because whatever this is my belief and my understanding. Whatever religion we look at, there's one commonality, and that is the belief that God is love.
Yeah.
And yeah. You know, L-O-V-E, love. Life's only vital emotion. It's vital. It's the only emotion that we were talking about George Best. But if a person puts down the chemical, starts their recovery process without increased spirituality in their life, there's a sense of rage. Is that it? Because what they're doing is a very, very cruel thing to themselves. They've taken their anesthetic away for their emotional pain, but they haven't put something in its place. And what,
yeah.
what needs to come in the place of the chemical or the person, if it's codependency, is love, is God.
Yeah, yeah. And that's so true, I think. And I think people eventually get that. And it's also interesting how that path develops, because I know that in my own case, I went down the church route to start with, you know.
Mm-hmm.
And fortunately, I was just in touch. I was enough in touch with my intuition and my feelings, and that it didn't quite fit for me, because I kept hearing separation.
Yeah.
And there was some part of me that knew that it wasn't supposed to be like this. You know, the whole idea of love was a universal thing with me.
Yeah.
And that that it was, we're trying to get rid of the concept of separation, where, and that's what I found and I encountered, and that may not be everybody's experience, but it was mine. And in the end, yeah, it just carried on until I found what fitted with me, you know.
So when the saints go marching in, there's going to be no first, no last. We're all going to go together, John.
That's it. That's the point. I love it. I think the Buddhists, isn't the Buddhists that say, you know, the ship don't sail till everyone's on the ship.
That's right.
Because, it's lovely. It's a lovely concept.
Because we're all one.
That's it. It's not a race. And no. What about yourself, Ralph? When you started the program at Cromwell Road, there, did you have a, you know, I mean, like one of the, I think I mentioned this last week, but one of the greatest lines I ever heard was, if you want to make God laugh, tell him your plans, you know.
Yeah.
Did you kind of think that you'd be there for a long time, or did you envision your own path, and which way has that taken?
I started there as a newly recovering person. I'd been addicted to drugs for 25 years, and I was about 6 months away from the chemicals, and you know, a big decision at that time was whether to have a cup of tea or a cup of coffee. I found people say, do you want something to drink, Ralph? And I go, yeah, I'll have whatever you're having, because
that's a common one, isn't it?
Yeah. So there I was, and you know, and I was looking back at my life, and I was thinking, well, what do I know? you know, I've got to the age of 40, and the only thing I know was that I invested 25 years in drugs and they've stopped working. So somebody suggested that, you know, I came in and spend a bit of time, rather like yourself, John, come in and do a bit of voluntary work. And, you know, that was the beginning of the process. You know, as a using addict, I had a theme song. I was always on my mind. I was always on my mind.
That's what I love. I must say, I loved working in there with you because, you know, regardless of the amount of pain and some of the stories you hear, I mean, they are amazing, aren't they? Incredible
yeah.
stories. And I always felt very humbled. But whatever happened, you know, there was always, you know, a good whack of humor as
yeah.
well involved. And I just have very happy memories there, you know.
And that's part of the healing process, not to laugh at another person, but to be able to laugh with them.
Absolutely, and laugh at ourselves. I think for me,
yeah, laugh at ourselves and you know, within that, the other person will find some empathy, some identification. So, no, I didn't have a plan, but. What seemed to happen and what always seems to happen is that the right people gravitated to Cromwell Road.
Yeah.
And people like yourself, John. And it became, I remember in the hallway, one of the residents had... done a painting of the house, and the painting was called The House of Love.
Oh, how wonderful. Yeah, and it was, you know, what you created there was very, very special. And of course, it ended up closing down, didn't it, because of funding, was it, or something? I don't know.
Yeah, because of funding. And but you see, what I found is if you work for the higher power, or if you work for the Holy Spirit, Great Spirit, whatever words you want to use, the higher power pays the wages, and that's not always in cash.
Absolutely, isn't that amazing? I mean, that is something which is really powerful, Ralph, which I know is true today. I absolutely know is true, and that's why I guess they emphasize in the program the importance of being in service. And of course, being
yeah.
in service can be in many, many different ways. You know, doesn't necessarily mean that we go kind of, you know, rescuing alcoholics and drug addicts off the street. And that's one way, but there are many ways to be in service. But it is about that giving of your own experience in order to help another and being there to, sometimes it's listening, isn't it?
It's very often listening. I remember a turning point in my journey. That same room that I first met you in, John. I was sat in there myself, and I was talking to somebody about me, and the person was listening, and. I hadn't had that for so long, a human being that was actually being attentive to me. And, you know, I began to feel my spirit rise. You know, at that time, it was like my spirit had almost gone out, like a candle that's kind of spluttering in the wind.
Yeah.
And, you know, that... I don't know how long, 15 minutes that he was there for me, gave his time to me, listened to me, just allowed my spirit to burn a little bit brighter.
Yeah, oh, it's so true. I mean, and if we could, you know, I'm as you know, passionate about parenting and kids and everything in that area.
Sure.
I think one of the greatest gifts we can give our kids and any human being, our partners or whatever, is the gift of listening. And and that can be made into a regular ritual. You know, one of the exercises that I learned on this journey was the listening exercise, where you just sit with your partner and you just listen, and one of you talk for 15 minutes or 30 minutes, whatever, and then there's nothing said at the end of it. There's no feedback, there's no comments, there's no, you know, it's just thank you, and then you switch over. It's an amazing experience, amazing.
I've got a friend that every year they give me a wall calendar, and it's a wall calendar with quotes on it. And there was one a couple of months ago, and the quote was, before I speak, I ask myself, am I going to be honest? No, firstly, am I going to be kind? And am I going to be honest? And is what I'm going to say, is it going to improve on the silence?
Wow. That is powerful, isn't it? That is really powerful.
So much can be said in silence.
Yeah. Well, that's right. And isn't that another difficult thing when we first get into this work and self-examination? I can remember being terrified of that circle of silence, actually wanting to run out the room, you know, not being able to sit there with nothing being said.
Well, so what I found, something was being said, but it was happening between my two ears, John. What I had between my two ears was the yak, 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 the voice of what in transaction analysis is known as the critical parent ego state. That uses words like should, ought, must.
Yeah.
Or shouldn't, absolutely. Mustn't. And part of my recovery process, part of your recovery process, I know, has been, somebody was talking to me about it earlier today, the ability to be alone, and they broke the word alone down to all one.
Yeah. Isn't that wonderful? Isn't it amazing how words can be broken down, you know, we're very blessed with this language, aren't we? You know, all one. Isn't that fantastic? And it's like another word which intrigued me when I found the word atonement.
Yes.
You know, and really in the traditional religious circles, and again, I want to make the point, I'm not criticizing any of those, you know, it works for a lot of people, but traditionally atonement is perceived and is interpreted as being atoning for something you've done wrong.
Yeah.
Where really, I break it down now, and it just means at-one-ment.
At-one
with ourselves.
So we're talking about forgiveness here, are we, John?
Yeah, that's which of course is what the course is all about, you know. Mm. But this is not traditional forgiveness, it's quantum forgiveness. It is the tool of recovery. And I think that's what the healing process is about. And, of course, so much of it is self-forgiveness. Well, it's all actually self-forgiveness, isn't it?
Yeah.
And, Ralph, while we're at the end there, I don't know if you've got one thing I wanted. I'd like you to share, if you could, if you've got your book there. I'm sure you have, and you probably know it off by heart. But I was just looking at my course today, in my Course in Miracles, and I found an amazing piece, which I'm going to share in a minute. But I thought about it. I thought, my goodness, that really is talking about the promises. Have you got the promises there at hand?
No, but I think I've pretty much got them in my head.
I think you have. Would you like to share that with our listeners? Because I always, when I used to hear them, it just gave me so much hope in those early days, you know?
Yeah. Well, I probably can't say them word perfectly, but... painstakingly honest about our recovery, we will realize that we are children of God, that we don't have to crawl before anybody. Fear of financial insecurity will leave us. and we will find that God is doing for us that which we were unable to do for ourselves.
Yeah, and it was beautiful, wasn't it? I mean, it gave so much hope, which is one of the first stages, I think, of recovery, if we can get out of that. Another thing I used to love, Bradshaw used to say about the work of a therapist, he said, working as a therapist, he says, it's a cruddy job. He said, you take people out of their misery and into their pain.
I remember being told in early recovery, what do you want, Ralph, the good news or the bad news? The good news is you're going to get in touch with your feelings, and the bad news is you're going to get in touch with your feelings.
Yeah, it's so true, though, isn't it? It's like taking you out of your misery and into your pain.
Yeah.
It's all about getting into those feelings which we'd blocked out for so many years in so many different ways, you know. Because the other is misery. I mean, you know, there's no question about it. Well, Ralph, I'd like to just share this piece in from the course here. It's beautiful, I think. It was given to me today by a friend of mine. And it's on page 37. And it says, because it's about forgiveness, as you know, and it says, an ancient hate is passing from the world, and with it goes all hatred and all fear. Look back no longer, for what lies ahead is all you ever wanted in your heart. Give up the world, but not to sacrifice. You never wanted it. What happiness have you sought here that did not bring you pain? I love that line. What happiness have you sought here that did not bring you pain? What moment of content has not been bought at fearful price in coins of suffering? Joy has no cost. It is your sacred right. And what you pay for is not happiness. Isn't that beautiful?
That's truly wonderful.
And that's really what the course is saying, you know. And when we recognise that the material world, the physical world, and all that stuff, and will only ever, at the end of the day, bring, you know, different levels of pain and sorrow without the spiritual connection. And I think that's what this journey takes in the end. Takes everybody. Everybody comes to the point, I believe, where they say there must be a better way.
Yeah, I'm kind of reminded of in Hinduism, this world is called Maya, the Great Illusion.
The Great Illusion, isn't that true? Isn't that true? Yeah. So what's the rest of the day bringing to you, Rob? What are you up to? You're still into your football?
I'm still into my football. I've just seen Chelsea have brought a new player today.
Good for you.
And I've been working today. I've spent some time with some people, and it's probably time that for me to have a little bit of quiet time and put my head on the pillow and rest.
Well, that's what I've always admired about you, Ralph. You've been a very dedicated person to this journey, and I want to thank you for coming on this evening, and I also want to thank you for the big part you played in my life and still play, and I love you. You're a beautiful man, and I wouldn't have been able to say that 10 years ago.
No.
And we've had many happy moments together, and I know we'll have many happy moments again. So thank you for your time tonight, and if people want to get in touch with you, what's the number they call, Ralph?
They can call me on 0044 1273 770 128, and it's Ralph McIntyre.
Okay, right. And do you have an email address as well, Ralph?
I do. It's Ralph IMac ralphimc@aol.com.
That's lovely. So that's, if anybody's interested in talking to Ralph, I can highly recommend him. It's 0044 for UK, 1273,
yeah.
770128, and the email is Ralph, ralphimc@aol.com.
That's right.
So thank you once again to Ralph, and have a wonderful evening, and it's been a great pleasure having you on. Thank you for being my guest tonight on Miracle Hour on BBS Radio.
John, just want to tell you I love you.
Thank you, my friend. Thank you so much, and we'll talk again soon.
We will.